now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everyone. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Paul Blake Smith. Paul Blake Smith was a guest on our show before, where he talked about the Cape Girardeau alien crash retrieval, and this occurred April 12, 1941. This was the bombshell before Roswell, which was a classic case, and we were very pleased to have Paul come on back then and talk about that case. Well, since then, Paul has come out with a new book, and the new book is about the encounters that President Eisenhower had with ETs. There's been much written and discussed over the years about an alleged meeting that President Eisenhower had with ETs at what was then known as Muroc Field, now known as Edwards Air Force Base. Well, Paul's here to talk about that. And the book is called President Eisenhower's Close Encounters by Paul Blake Smith. So without any further ado, Paul, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's my pleasure.
Paul, put our readers into the picture, let's say the overall strategic picture around that time frame in the early to mid-1950s. President Eisenhower was in office, and lead us up to the point where this encounter took place and the circumstances leading up to it.
Right. People probably don't recall or don't realize how mega popular Dwight Eisenhower was around the world. He was the supreme Allied commander in Europe that helped bring all the forces of the Allies together to crush the Nazi war machine. And he came home to a ticker tape parade and was honored and showered with as much praise and as much hero worshiping as this country has ever seen. President Truman hired him for his Army Chief of Staff, and he served a few other positions. And by early 1952, he was mulling over whether he should run for president or not, and he decided to give it a go. And when he did run, he crushed his opponent in the fall election and took office in January of 1953. So riding high in the polls, Eisenhower further endeared himself to the American people by wrapping up the Korean War in the first year of his presidency. During his campaign, he said he would go to Korea. And as soon as he won the election, he told the reporters, "I'm going to be holed up in my home in New York City. You won't be seeing me, but I'm going to be interviewing candidates for my cabinet." And this is a somewhat important story because it turns out Eisenhower lied. He wasn't there, but cabinet candidates showed up every day for the press, and they recorded them going in and out of the building. And meanwhile, Eisenhower got on a plane and flew all the way to Korea. It was a kind of a top secret mission that he did not want the Russians or Chinese or Koreans to know about. So they had to fib a little and say, "Ike is in his house, but you won't be seeing him because he'll be so busy." Well, that was a clue that we have that Eisenhower knew to keep the press distracted. He pulled off the meeting and he came back to America safe and sound and had a successful first year of his presidency. And then by February of 1954, he went on a hunting vacation to Georgia. And then he went back to Washington, D.C. And just a couple days later, flew on the 17th of February of 54 to Palm Springs, California, supposedly on a golf trip. He just wanted to relax and play golf. Now that seems more and more dubious considering Eisenhower was obsessed with the Augusta golf course. He had just been in Georgia. He had played it like dozens of times, so much so that his supporters built him a house on the fairway out there. And now he thinks he has to fly 2,500 miles to the desert of California out in Palm Springs just to play golf for a few days. When you think about it, the cover story was pretty lame, but that's what they did. And by Thursday the 18th, he was golfing with some friends and he allowed the press in. But after that, he said, "No more press. The president wants to golf without being recorded." So they were just told for a while that he was out golfing. And on the 19th, he apparently did go golfing. We think it's him. But that night, the press was distracted by a well-organized party at their hotel in Palm Springs. That's the night I feel that Eisenhower slipped away from town, using that party as a diversion to keep the media occupied. And he flew all the way to Edwards Air Force Base, sometimes referred to as Muroc, which was its old name. And he managed to go there and get back maybe around midnight or later without being detected. And no one was the wiser. Or were they? Reports started seeping out in the days and weeks afterwards, these rumors that Eisenhower went out to the airbase to meet friendly extraterrestrial beings who had landed. And this was even reported on the air by Frank Edwards, who was a very popular mutual broadcasting system reporter. He was almost like the Art Bell of his day. He reported a lot of UFO stories, and he had a listenership of apparently over a million people. And apparently he talked about this story that he'd been hearing. Eisenhower went out to an airbase, and he met with landed aliens who came down in five different ships. It's a pretty wild story, isn't it? I mean, your first reaction is, oh, come on. But the more I keep piecing together on this story, I feel it really did happen. He swore everyone to secrecy, made it back to Palm Springs, and played golf for the next few days. And then he flew back to Washington, D.C., and he, in a sense, got away with it, in the short term anyway.
What was the exact date of the cover story party slash alleged trip to Edwards? Again, what was the date, Paul?
Friday night, February 19th, 1954. It's been reported in a few books that it must have been the 20th, because Eisenhower had this alleged dental emergency, and he left his rented house where he was staying with some friends, and he supposedly received treatment. And for many years, people thought that story must be the night he was out with extraterrestrials, and it is not. I looked into this pretty closely and talked to a woman who spoke to a woman who was at the Smoke Tree Ranch, which is where Eisenhower was staying. And Eisenhower really did have a dental emergency Saturday night, and it took several hours for him to get treated. So that's not the night of the alien encounter. It was the night before, the 19th.
That's interesting, because we're getting quite close to the anniversary of all this, too.
Right.
Now that you mention it. What were some of the primary and secondary sources for the story, Paul, and how did were you able to piece that all together?
Over the years, it's been reported, if you have ancient aliens from the History Channel in Australia or anywhere else, they reported on this. And something called MUFON Hangar 1 has done a segment on this. And Alien Files Decoded or Declassified or whatever they call it. They've all done a little segment, and you think, wow, this is like the biggest story ever. Where is a full-length book? Where's a documentary or a major motion picture on this? Well, I got tired of waiting and decided to piece together my own book. But when I researched this for years, a big problem was, of course, that everyone is dead. There was a pilot from Edwards Air Force Base, a test pilot from the Air Force, who spoke up in the early 1980s and said, I want to tell you about this story, because everyone else who was with me at the time is now deceased, and I don't want the story to die out. So he was a main focus of a story that came out in, unfortunately, the National Enquirer in 1982, and it was picked up and run by some other newspapers. And people began to open their eyes to this story because they remember a few dribs and drabs leaking out in the 1950s. Valor magazine had a story on Eisenhower at the airbase to inspect alien things in October of 54 from someone who had heard these rumors as well. So it's not completely covered up at the time. It just kind of went to sleep for about 30 years. And the story picked up a few more pieces or clues of pointing to what happened. I wish we could talk to someone who has direct knowledge, but I'm sure they're passed on by now, and in many cases, their children are probably passed on. And to make matters worse, Eisenhower swore everyone to secrecy. And even the test pilot who spoke up in the early 80s said, yes, he did swear us to secrecy, but I'm breaking my oath before this story dies out. And he said the story is true, that Eisenhower showed up at the airbase that night, and he had a security personnel around him of about six people, and they waited, and the extraterrestrials stepped out of their ships and walked up to the edge of the hangar. They were inside an airbase hangar, and that this story of meeting them and speaking in English with them is all true. He said, I ought to know, I was there. So that's a classic example. And then I pieced together lots of other stories, clues, allegations. A number of people have said they've seen a file with this, including a United States congressman. And so I piece all the puzzle pieces together and come up with, I think, what is a pretty strong circumstantial case that I believe it, that the story really did happen. And it may have been the first of one or two more. If you've ever heard of researcher Art Campbell, we could get into that as well.
Yes, please. I'm not familiar with the name. Can you enlighten me on Art Campbell and his research?
Yeah, Art Campbell was a UFO researcher in America, and he hailed from Missouri, my home state, but he passed on about 2 years ago. His story was that Eisenhower, in February of 55, went to Holloman Air Force Base, and he collected a few eyewitnesses who said, we saw his plane land. We saw two round discs come down out of the sky over the runway. One of them hovered in space or in the air, and the other landed, and that someone, they think probably Eisenhower himself, got out of what would have been Air Force One, or the Columbine, as they called it back then, and walked over to the alien ship, and there was an exchange of something. And after a little while, Eisenhower, or whoever this person was, went back to the plane. And then Eisenhower went into the airbase and swore, everyone said it was done at a theater in the base. And he said, we don't need to be talking about this. This is top secret, matter of national security. Whatever you may have seen, you know, for the good of your country, please keep your mouth shut. And there was a bit of a delay for an hour or two. And then Eisenhower finally got back on his plane and flew back to back east. And these people who gave this story to Art Campbell swore up and down they could see this. One of them was a telephone lineman who was up on his telephone line at the time and scrambled down real fast when he saw these two extraterrestrial-looking craft come down over the airbase. So this would have been about 1 year from the Edwards Air Base meeting, and it may have been the conclusion of a treaty between humans and aliens that was first brought up by Eisenhower to please keep yourselves as obscure as possible. You have to come here. Don't show yourself too openly. Don't land and try to talk to people. If you have to make contact with humans, do it on an isolated, remote basis out in the wilderness or the countryside. So that may have been the result, the 55 meeting, of coming to a formal agreement. And I put in my book a document that says that there was agreement between aliens and the U.S. government back then, and then gives some of the specific wording. So I think people will enjoy reading that. I try to put as much of that document as I can in the appendix of my book. If you can find that at Amazon.com, I think you'll really enjoy that.
Interesting how it would be at Holloman, which has figured prominently in the research in the past. There was a similar incident, not including Eisenhower, and the dates vary. According to some sources, it was 1964 when likewise a couple of craft showed up at Holloman Air Force Base. Apparently, there was an agreement to return alien bodies that had been recovered in the various alien crash sites over the years. And then another version of the story says that the aliens showed up in 68, but Holloman could have been one of those places like Edwards where, if not frequent, at least these would have been places that had the security and had the personnel required to pull off these kinds of encounters. Now, another person who figures in the research, and I don't know how much you delved into this particular story, but one of the ways that I first found out about the Eisenhower alien meeting in 54 was through reading Mead Lane's work. He was the president of Borderlands Research, something along those lines. And apparently, for whatever reason, right, it was decided he was to be brought to Edwards to witness this. Could you elaborate more on Mead Lane's story?
Right. Newton Mead Lane was a man who ran a paranormal research facility called Borderland Sciences. And he did not actually go to Edwards Air Force Base, but he made contact with a gentleman who did. And naturally, this guy's name escapes me. if you can jog my memory, he was an older man. He was into paranormal research, and he wrote a letter that's now famous, typed it up when he got home in April of 54, and said that I was at the Air Force Base. I made the trip from Los Angeles in the company of three men, and he named them. And it's interesting that one of the men, Cardinal Francis McIntyre, used to have open records for researchers to go through. And when UFO researchers showed up, those records were closed up pretty quick. The gentleman in question wrote this letter to Newton Mead Lane in San Diego and sent it to him. And it's a classic in its field. And I reprint the letter in its entirety in my book. It says that in early April, he went out to Edwards Air Force Base, and here were aliens with five different craft, just like what was described at the landing event in February. And he said, I could see with my own eyes these Etherians, he called them. He had a special name for aliens of that nature, and he used it again to describe that event. And they were interacting with Air Force officials at Edwards Air Force Base, and he was told that President Eisenhower had been here during his Palm Springs vacation in February. And there's another clue that the story really is true. So that letter is most fascinating, and Mead Lane accepted it. I'm not sure which party leaked it. Perhaps after death, the families leaked the letter. But I recommend, if you're looking into this story, reading this tale that this man printed up on one sheet of paper and mailed probably as soon as he got home. I would think he wanted to get the memories down while they were still fresh in his mind.
The description of the ETs, did the test pilot go into any in-depth description of what the beings looked like? How many were there?
Right. That's what everybody wants to know. What they look like? Well, he did not give too much detail, but he did say that they looked like humans, but not exactly. They had slightly different features from a human being, but they're what I would call cousins to the human race. I should think that they had slightly different nostrils, noses, and lungs and diaphragm for breathing their own atmosphere on their own planet. According to a Army Intelligence Manual, you've probably heard of it, 101 Field Manual for people who are in Army Intelligence who gathered up extraterrestrial materials or went to landing events. It was dated April of 54. They gave a description of human-like aliens that may have had somewhat grayish or grayish-yellow skin and had very little hair of any sort on their heads. It was more like a little fuzz at the top, and they described him as about 5 feet tall. And I feel that's probably a description of the Edwards Air Force base encounter aliens, because it came out about 2 months later. It would have been printed up, and this would have been almost an exact match for what this test pilot said he saw.
Some of the accounts that I've read about the Edwards Air Force Base encounter dealt with the dialogue between Eisenhower and the ETs. Now, in that time frame, there was a lot of stories coming out, coming out from so-called contactees who reported, for the most part, friendly encounters with ETs. Oftentimes, ETs would be human-looking. The people would be invited onto the craft, given a guided tour, shown the technology, and they were oftentimes left with messages or imparted with warnings. And one of the warnings often had to do with the development of atomic weapons. They used to call it in those days atomic weapons and hydrogen weapons. And some of the lore, correct me if I'm wrong, arising out of the Eisenhower ET meeting was that the ETs had asked Eisenhower to halt the development of nuclear weapons because it was having an impact on all these other dimensions, not just in our own. Do you have anything to add to that? Did you hear anything along those lines?
I did exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head, and probably the entire reason why aliens would make contact face to face and try to reason with the man in charge. And that would have been, of course, President Eisenhower, leader of the free world, president of the United States, head of the military, and who authorized all these atomic bomb tests. Now, there was one plan for early March, like March 1st, and it was a gigantic mess. Eisenhower went on with that atomic test, despite what he learned from his alien friends in person. And the test was way, way larger in the detonation in the South Pacific on March 1st. It was an environmental disaster. There was contamination, radiation fallout in the land, the sea, the air, the fish. Some Japanese fishermen got terribly sick, and it started an uproar. And Eisenhower soon lost some of his popularity around the world because they thought this was pretty reckless. The American response to it was pretty slow. That was the Castle Bravo explosion, an atomic bomb test in a small island in the Pacific. Well, that may well have been something that the aliens were aware was going to happen, and they were none too pleased, and they wanted to talk him out of it. He had this Castle program, which was a series of atomic bomb tests that were rather recklessly going off in the atmosphere, in the land, under the ocean, just crazy weapons testing that we have not seen in like 50, 60 years, thanks to a test ban treaty put together by President Kennedy. But at the time, this was going on, and it was like American scientists were playing with matches and gasoline. And this had to have been deeply concerning to the aliens, and that's the research that I found also. They wanted to talk to him about, could you stop doing this? Eisenhower was also arming the world. He was into manufacturing atomic weapons and then shipping them overseas, putting them American battleships if necessary, and putting in foreign countries. And this escalated the Cold War. The Russians did the same, the British to some extent. And so this was probably quite alarming to any friendly and concerned alien race monitoring us from a bit of a distance.
Castle Bravo was described as a runaway. It had a yield far in excess of what the developers had thought. And it basically obliterated a whole island. Like you said, the fallout was just tremendous. The Japanese fishermen, all the American servicemen that were there were exposed. It was just an outright environmental disaster. And you know, the scary part is, you know, Paul was still planning a whole series of these things.
Incredibly, he went ahead with it, even though they asked him not to. Even though the Castle Bravo was a disaster, the testing went on until the middle of May of 54. Nothing was going to talk him out of it.
This should be placed firmly in context because, and I'm glad you brought these issues up, Eisenhower being a military man, only later on, you know, with the advent of the Kennedy administration, et cetera, did we have this notion of flexible response as far as a graduated response leading up to and including the use of nuclear weapons. Whereas in Eisenhower's time and within the ranks of the military at the time, there was this concept. It wasn't so much overwhelming force. It was a concept of we will use the weapons we have at hand to affect the decisive outcome. And to the point where, like you said, they forward deployed nuclear weapons to Guam, Anderson Air Force Base. They made contingency plans in case the Chinese walked out of the Panmunjom peace treaty talks and developed a new round of hostility. The Americans were ready to start nuking the Chinese industrial base. I mean, people don't realize just we were closer to nuclear war in the 1950s by far than we were at the Cuban Missile Crisis, because the Soviets backed down in the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was really no chance of a nuclear meltdown. But the odds were more likely that nuclear warfare would have occurred in the 1950s, because America was coming on the heels of victory on a two-front war in World War II. And, you know, quite frankly, they were feeling their oats as far as, you know, we're not going to put up with any kind of nonsense from these communists. If it comes to it, we're going to use nuclear weapons. And I can see how the aliens would be really alarmed by that fact.
I quite agree. Eisenhower really stepped up production of atomic weapons and testing. There had been plenty done during the Truman administration, to be fair. And Kennedy saw this and, you know, he realized this is madness. But when the Russians saw all of this proliferation of arms, they started stepping up their testing and they're moving atomic weapons around. And that really did lead to that Cuban missile crisis with our Jupiter missiles in Turkey and such that came to a head in October of 62. Eisenhower apparently told the aliens at the encounter of February 19th, 54, I'm not going to disarm unilaterally. I want to see other nations disarm. So he kept up his program, and nothing was going to talk him out of it. He thought it meant American strength.
Another point about the meeting between Eisenhower, the initial meeting, as far as we know, between Eisenhower and the ETs was, there's been some talk bruited about that the ETs at some point wanted to reveal themselves en masse. And Eisenhower thought this would not be a good idea. In hindsight, he was probably right, considering all the issues coming up with communism and everything else, and the world trying to heal from a ruinous world war. What are your thoughts on that? And is that something that came up in the discussions, as far as you're aware, too, this notion that the aliens were going to start to reveal themselves en masse to the public? And also, if you can also elaborate about what details have emerged as far as this treaty between that particular group of ETs and Eisenhower and the Americans.
Eisenhower was really impressed to a fault by this meeting with aliens. They came down in five craft. Three were said to be circular, or, you know, flying saucers, and two were cigar-shaped. And at one point, the aliens said, we'd like to begin an education program for the people of Earth to let you know that you're not alone and that we're here. And I don't know if they talked about other races, but they decided to put on an aerial show for the president. Here's what our ships can do. And they were quite dazzling and outstripped anything that we have in our skies. Eisenhower knew this would be most unsettling to the American people, and that if they saw this going on rather openly, they would be frightened. There would be many people who might just literally panic. Others would maybe even worship aliens. You never know. Eisenhower was a very conservative Christian gentleman. He even had himself baptized in his first month in the White House. No other president had ever been baptized before. He went to church the next Sunday to show his continuing faith. So he did not like the idea that the aliens would be showing themselves and their craft, and that people would be paying less attention to work and school and religion and hobbies, and could see that this was not going to fly. Next came something else that the aliens did that really rattled Ike, and I think it was the last straw. The aliens overplayed their hand. They showed how they could manipulate their appearance to make themselves invisible, probably through cloaking. They were here, according to the test pilot, and then they disappeared from our sight, and then a few seconds later, they reappeared. And I think he said some of them reappeared in different places, like they had moved. And Eisenhower had to have been beside himself. looking at this thinking, you want to educate humanity to this? This cannot happen. Can you imagine spies, murderers, thieves, rapists, all sorts of devious people learning this ability to cloak themselves and get into boardrooms and bedrooms and banks and just anywhere they want to go, slipping in unnoticed? Aliens teaching this with or without permission to humanity, showing themselves in ships that can far outstrip our jet airliners or our Air Force jets. So he thought, this cannot be. You're going to have to go and not show yourself. And that led to the parameters of an agreement. The aliens wanted to come to Earth, apparently, and study our plants and animals and people, as you would if you came from any other race of beings or any other planet. So I believe the agreement included finding an air base, which apparently was out in the desert of Nevada, and to be allowed to land and come and go and study in a kind of scientific lab. And in exchange, the aliens would provide some technology to humanity. I get this from a document that I included in the appendix of my book. I believe it's very likely what Eisenhower negotiated over a one-year period and came back to Holloman Air Force Base, which was a much shorter trip across the country, it should be pointed out, also a remote desert air base in 55. And they came to this agreement that as long as the aliens were friendly, they would be considered acceptable ambassadors or diplomats from another world. And as long as they continue to provide American scientists with new concepts and new technology, they would be allowed to come and go here. But for the most part, Eisenhower's main concern was, don't set off a panic. Don't start a social revolution or a chaos and have the stock market go south and have people quitting their jobs or schools or mass invading an Air Force base that they think aliens are at, whether they are or not. It just would have been nuts if the aliens had been allowed to appear here quite openly. And it may well still be that way to this day.
The implications would have been profound. And what I like about your research, Paul, is you place all this within the historical context of the times. You talked earlier about the development of what they called atomic weapons back then, nuclear weapons, and then going forward, hydrogen weapons. But there was also talking about infiltration, subversion of spies and what have you. Right around that time frame was a series of spy scandals where particularly the British military intelligence foreign ministry nexus had been deeply, deeply penetrated by Soviet moles for decades. And then we started having stories coming out about atomic espionage and how the Soviets had infiltrated the Manhattan Project going forward. So Eisenhower definitely would have had all this in mind. If these beings can become invisible and perhaps even assume some kind of guise when they were visible, that just opens up a whole can of worms that he didn't want to have to deal with. And also the notion of the invisibility, because the accounts that I read about this stated that Eisenhower was shown this invisibility capability by the ETs, and he would feel the craft. He could feel the presence of the craft by touching it, but it simply was not in the visible spectrum. And apparently he became quite upset by this. Being a military man again, the implications were profound. How does this play with radar? How does this play with ground air intercept and air to air intercept? It must have just did Eisenhower's head in to have to ponder all the imponderables, Paul.
You're quite right. That's what I believe was a huge factor. The military officer within him defending America and our allies. Can you imagine this technology getting loose and the Russians gaining access through espionage? The Chinese, our friends in other countries would probably naturally want it, like Britain or Israel or France. It was something that he felt like, oh, we've got to keep a wrap on this. This is just dreadful, the notion of what could happen. And you're quite right. Remember Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote The Day After Roswell?
Yes.
Passed away some years ago. He wrote that the CIA was being heavily infiltrated by Russian intelligence in the 50s, and that he warned the Kennedy brothers in the early 60s, don't trust the CIA, don't run secrets by them. They had been infiltrated. So I think you're quite right. That was a huge problem for Eisenhower. He was aware of Russian treachery and espionage going on in this country, and maybe even Americans who might have sold their soul to, so to speak, to sell technology or information to the Russians, not just Russian or Eastern European agents themselves, but the temptation being too strong, being offered money for information or data. So Eisenhower was just aghast by the whole thought. The more he thought about it, actually, I think he realized we can't have this. This has to be kept a secret.
What's also interesting is I'm sure you've come across the Majestic documents by the Wood father-son team, Robert and Ryan, I think their name is. And being a student of the Second World War myself, I really don't have any problems with a lot of the information that's come forth from the Majestic documents, because a lot of the high-ranking military and scientific engineering personnel would have been actually the exact types of individuals they would have needed to oversee such a project as the reverse engineering and analysis of recovered alien technology. One of the documents in there was from 1947, at the time of Roswell. Again, the historical context. So in 1947, at the time of Roswell, the Army Air Forces were still technically under the Army, and Eisenhower was chief of staff at the time. And there is a document in the Majestic documents where Eisenhower orders General Nathan Twining of the Air Material Command, based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, to go to New Mexico to inspect the recovered technology there. And then further, when you read the documentation, there is a secret meeting between General Nathan Twining and Air Force Chief of Staff General Carl Spatz. And a lot of people who study World War II will be familiar with that name. Apparently, there was a secret meeting between Twining and Spatz at Alamogordo, which later became Kirtland Air Force Base. So by the time Eisenhower came into office, and there's been a lot of debate and discussion about the validity of the Majestic 12 documents. I personally, like I said, I don't have any qualms with the personnel that were alleged to have been involved in Majestic 12, because any study of research and development coming out of World War II and any study of the intelligence and military backgrounds of the military personnel involved, those would have been exactly the right kind of people to have on such an agency as Majestic 12, and they would have created a Majestic 12 type organization. There would have to have been some group overseeing all this. But the point of relevance, Paul, is in the Majestic 12 documentation, not only do they mention the other military personnel involved to Eisenhower, General Hoyt Vandenberg, General Nathan Twining, et cetera, they point out that because of the untimely death of Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, they had to include General Walter Beadle Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff in World War II, and who was also, by that time, director of CIA. So it makes sense from that context that Eisenhower, to some degree, was already aware of the research and analysis and investigations into the alien presence on Earth. And of course, by the time he becomes president, it's time to put him into the picture.
I quite agree. General Smith was very close to Eisenhower, like a real mentor and trusted by Ike. And he would have been a natural pick to put on that committee. Even if Eisenhower was not president at the time, he would have recommended it very strongly to Truman. The Majestic documents, also called the Eisenhower briefing documents of November of 52, have been debated for so long, and the critics come back and say one thing, and then the supporters say, you know, this is an explanation of that. And it's compelling. I watched a documentary online. I recommend it to others. Do You Believe in Magic? M-A-J-I-C. It points out the validity of the documents and arguments that the supporters make are genuine. And I think the main thing that really helped put me over the top, or I think they're probably true documents, is the letter Z. And that's in the typing of the document. The letter Z is raised up off the normal print line whenever it's used. And they interviewed someone from the Army printing office who said, oh, yes, we had raised Zs on all of our documents of that period because the Z was seldom used and it collected dust and lint and crud underneath it. And that's what pushed it up a little off the line of the normal type set. So these documents have that letter Z raised. And that's another clue that this really did come off an Army printing press, Army intelligence, and that it was a briefing document. Probably Eisenhower knew most of the information in that anyway. But it's quite fascinating that all of the names on the MJ-12 committee, Majestic 12, these academic and military personnel who combined to study UFO recoveries and alien bodies and such and give advice to the president. All of them had died until just before they were leaked. Like the last one of the committee from the 50s had passed away, and then the document showed up and they've been debated ever since. I'll point out really quick, General Nathan Twining died in March of 1982, and it was shortly thereafter this test pilot stepped forward and said, all of the people at the meeting are now deceased, and I feel free to talk about it. Twining would have wanted that information kept quiet, but with him gone, he may have well been there at the time. Who knows? He was the Air Force Chief of Staff and later became the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was a very important figure indeed.
Yes, and another thing that people need to understand, Paul, and I'd like your thoughts about this. These are people, Eisenhower, General Nathan Twining. If one peruses the Majestic documents in the Ryan Wood, Robert Wood website, majesticdocuments.com, there is even references to General Curtis LeMay as being an advisor to the MJ-12 committee. We're talking about people, Paul, who were used to playing high-stakes poker. We are talking about people who played a key role in the most ruinous war in known history, like LeMay's firebombing campaign against Japan. Nathan Twining was the commander of 15th Air Force in Italy, and during his stint in the Pacific, he floated around for about 6 days when his plane came to grief, and he was floating around the Coral Sea somewhere, okay, trying to avoid sharks and Japanese patrols. And then when you read some of the declassified documents during the Korean War, this is when Twining was chief of staff. He'd succeeded General Hoyt Vandenberg by then, and he's sending messages back and forth to General Curtis LeMay at Strategic Air Command. They're just calmly discussing the amount of nuclear weapons that they should allocate in case the Chinese get belligerent again, and just about how they're going to wipe out the Chinese industrial base. Not just using right. it tactically, but wiping out entire cities. So, you know, the people should understand these are people that played high stakes poker. And when people say, oh, just disclose everything, we need to know everything. Really? Really? You're going to be making decisions at that level on behalf of all of us when you, the general public, know nothing about the subject, know nothing about the background of all this. I'm not saying give all the power to the military. But what I'm saying is coming out of World War II, it was probably a good thing, Paul, that they maintained secrecy. I object to the levels of secrecy and the intimidation, the threats, the outright murder of people that knew too much about the subject. But to some degree, after World War II, it would have been, I think it would have been folly for people to have known about this in general because of the implications involved and the dangers that were involved in as far as nuclear war, et cetera, concerned. I'd like your thoughts on that.
You've probably heard UFO researchers say, well, what we found out is that aliens were considered above top secret, or even to some cosmic top secret, like above normal secret level. Yeah. General LeMay is even more of a nightmare the more you read about him. He was working on a plan in the mid-50s to aggressively bomb like Russia and anyone who stood in our way, working on a plan on how we would drop nuclear bombs on Russian cities to get the advantage that we could say, well, there's been a nuclear war, but we win because we struck first. And of course, that was madness. And it was shelved, but he went on to lead a firebombing campaign in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And he was also a leading advocate in JFK's ear during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We've got to go in there and start bombing these Russian nuclear sites. He was all in favor of shoot first, ask questions later. So this was one of the advisors to a president. In a more peaceful era, it's kind of frightening what he was capable of pushing and promoting and planning. I don't know how much input he had on the alien issue, but it's possible that he did have access to the MJ-12 committee and influenced them in some manner. I wish he did not, but in those days, people thought we could just explode all of these bombs and get away with it. And they just don't understand radiation fallout, chemicals in the air, encircling the atmosphere of the Earth, that to this day we haven't dropped a bomb in war since World War II. And they're just very, very environmentally unfriendly, to put it politely.
Well, they came away with all the wrong lessons, Paul. It's like they came away with a notion that, well, atomic bombs are just another weapon in the inventory. No different than artillery shells or firebombing or naval gunfire. It's all the same to them. And I hope the people don't misunderstand me when I say that on the one hand, I can understand the secrecy. But on the other, it was just the mindset of these military people. When they did recover the craft and they did recover the technology, and then this exchange took place between certain ET groups and deep elements of the military and what became the huge aerospace corporation cartel. The mindset was, well, let's weaponize this stuff. It's never about, well, what can we do to use this technology to, you know, prolong our lifespans and, you know, eradicate illnesses and provide unending limits of free, clean energy. No, they don't think like that. So on the one hand, I want people to understand that the mindset of these military people was geared up basically from the mindset they developed out of World War II. And on the other hand, for people at that time to say that, oh, they should have just let all this information all come out, I used to be an advocate of that. But, you know, the amount of social upheaval it would have caused as far as religions, as far as the stock market is concerned, what have you, it would have been catastrophic. Now, I think times have changed. It seems to me that there is an effort, a very concerted effort now, to plant the minds of the people, the populace, that aliens are here, they've existed with us, they've coexisted all along, and it's been a gradual incremental process to let people know that aliens are here without unduly alarming them. Unfortunately, I think that what they're going to do is take that information and control that narrative yet again in a way that's detrimental to human society, Paul.
I agree. There were some science fiction movies about flying saucers and evil aliens that invade and the day the Earth stood still and such back in the early 50s. But it's just far more mainstream today to have TV shows, comic books, comic strips, cartoons, major motion pictures. Everyone talks about ETs. We joke about it and we think lightly. And then we have all kinds of sci-fi movies now of exploring alien worlds or being attacked by aliens. It's much more in our mindset and accepted in today's world. Back in the early 50s, this was not nearly as mainstream, other than a few silly black and white movies considered B-movies. So that was another factor. I think two things Eisenhower had to keep in mind, and I'm sure he did in the past, was first, the reaction by some people to the October 1938 War of the Worlds play that was broadcast by Orson Welles, and that some people mildly panicked and took up some guns and went out in the countryside looking for aliens. Some people had stressful heart attacks or such and called police stations and newspaper offices asking about this alien invasion. They were a small minority, but still, it gave people an example to this day that some folks might panic. They just don't take kindly to the idea of aliens landing. And Eisenhower had to have had that in his mind, that people would panic if he openly spoke about this encounter or showed it on television. And the second thing is, Eisenhower and his entire generation remembered the stock market crash and how it devastated the American economy for over 10 years and rebounded like a domino effect all the way around the world. Everyone went into an economic crisis, a financial crunch. Homelessness and unemployment were at nightmare levels, and nobody wants to go back to that. You have to keep the stock market on Wall Street in America calm and pacified and chugging along and not let them be upset and have any kind of crash event. So there's still more factors why Eisenhower would want this covered up and everything to go about life in America calmly and not upset people.
We've reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guest, Paul Blake Smith. Paul, could you give our listeners your website and how they can contact you if they have any questions?
You can go to www.mo41.info, M-O-41.info. You can look me up on Facebook. President Eisenhower's Close Encounters is a special Facebook page. I've got a author's page. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn, and I'm supposed to be on Instagram, but I really don't do anything there. And Pinterest, you can find me or the Eisenhower story, and I'd be happy to hear any insight that someone might have or access to documents or someone in the family who might have known. It's a very exciting subject that I sure wish we could get more facts for, but buying the book from Amazon or foundationsbooks.net is an excellent place to start.
And to our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.